Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org. You can't help but smile today.
Yes.
It is actually spring. It is like almost 80 degrees out.
I would say summer. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah, no, I would say even more apropos to have you here with this cookbook on a day like this in the studio today, Yvette Von Boven. If you don't know her work, homemade cookbooks, they're just wonderful pieces of art.
Thank you.
Her husband and collaborator, luckily, is in studio too. Oaf.
Yes, that's me.
Hi. Excellent. But what is the actual name?
It's actually Oliver, but I couldn't pronounce it when I was really young, so my mom sort of thought it was cute that I called myself Ophie, so she kept it going, and then nobody knows my name different than that. That's it, but it turns out a little bit awkward sometimes in English-speaking countries.
Yeah.
But I'll fit the profile, though, because it works.
You could have made a whole different profile of yourself. We're on air. No one can see.
I know.
You.
I know. That's my lucky break today.
Yeah.
He's blonde and skinny.
Yeah, skinny and
Scandinavian rather than Dutch. So, the Dutch, the Netherlands, Amsterdam. Yeah. People think those are three different places. Can you explain where you're from and what that land is like?
The Dutch, the Netherlands, yeah, and we also have Holland. Well, I'm from Amsterdam, so that's in a country called Holland, and that is in the Netherlands, which is quite complicated. It's like Holland is like New Jersey or Michigan, you know, like what do you call it?
It's a province.
It's a province, yeah, yeah.
Actually, it's two. You got the north and the south.
Holland.
And together with nine other provinces, they form the Netherlands.
Yeah,
gotcha. I just want to talk maybe about those preconceptions about life and about food there, mm-hmm. because you know, aside from Gouda and like Edam cheeses, that is the limit of
that's
you know
it.
My culture. That's everything.
You don't
that's
know
it.
About pea soup.
No. I mean, I've seen the pea soup, but I don't know about the pea soup.
Well, we don't have a very very you know. Well, it is nice, but it's a very basic kitchen, the Dutch kitchen is. So, because I think the Dutch are from not a very luxurious point of view, so they would cook things with potatoes and sausage and fat, you know, to get the workers going on the country in the countryside. And also, they like pancakes, sweet things like waffles and poffertjes, which are very small pancakes, yeah. Like small like that size.
So pretty much brunch all day.
No, I wouldn't say that. I would like potato. Think potato mash and kale and carrots, things like that. Very peasantly, humble food.
So, I mean, you were actually born in Amsterdam, but lived in Dublin in Ireland?
No, born in Dublin.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So
and
lots
I
of
was raised,
there.
Yeah, and we moved back to Holland when I was 10 years old, and then I spent a big part of my life there.
So what was your culinary heritage? Did you try to bring the Irish with you, or did you find a new once you moved to Amsterdam?
I think I found a new. My parents are from the south of Holland, very, very deep south, so that's almost Belgium. So that's a little bit different from the north part of Holland. They would eat more like the French do with courses and more luxurious kind of way of eating. So that's the first part of my life. They would make, always have a starter, always have a main dish, always have dessert for lunch and dinner. And growing up in Ireland, there was not a lot of food, or it was a very poor time. It was about 60s, 70s. So everybody made everything themselves. So I think that's my homemade background. Yeah. We had to make everything ourselves, not only, you know, food, but also dresses. Or when I wanted to have toys, my mom would say, well, here's a piece of wood, you have to carve it yourself. But that was nice. Well, we learned a lot about that.
Oliver, and I'm going to call you Oliver.
That's fine.
Were you crafty like that? Did you grow up in Amsterdam?
No, I grew up in The Hague, which is a little bit further south in Holland. I was brought up in a hippie commune, so I had two dads and three moms, and we were all sort of a crafty bunch as well, so that helped.
Yeah, it's just
pretty much the same kind of upbringing.
I mean, was that not there in Amsterdam? Were there shops that people went to and purchased their larder, purchased their sausages, and brought it home? Was it a society that didn't know how to make a lot of the things that...
What do you think in Amsterdam?
Yeah.
I actually wouldn't know. I mean, I didn't grow up there. I think it would be... the shops had more stuff than we had in Ireland. Because when we went back on the holidays, we went back, not to Amsterdam, but to the south, I remember that the shops were stocked better than what I knew. Yeah.
So you were a crafty person. What did you go to school for? What did you do for work? Was it always focused around something that was homemade?
I went to School of the Arts in Holland, in Belgium first, in Antwerp, and then I went to The Hague. That's where Ove grew up and where I got to meet him. We went to the same School of the Arts, and I studied interior architecture there. So I started off as an interior architect, and I worked in kitchens always on the side, you know, to earn some extra money. So, yeah, it's a very different start of life.
Yeah, but it's a very similar mindset as far as structure goes. I think the arts get this bad rap for being liberal arts or something that's creative without any kind of structure. And there is a lot of structure in the
arts. There is, of course there is, yeah.
And Oliver, did you study photography?
Yes, I did, at the Royal Academy of Arts in The Hague, and which takes you 4 years. And I did an internship, and then sort of the classic way it's supposed to go, an assistant, and then I started out for myself.
Yeah,
yeah,
classic over there. Here, everybody gets out of school. And
yeah, but I've been around for quite a bit, and I started out in the time when there was no digital photography, so it was actually a sort of a craft.
Yeah.
And, you had to learn something before you just get a camera and get an image anyway. So
yeah. No, I just like hearing the word craft, because everything that you do today is craft, is, you know, not just homemade. It's not just, you know, this simple merriment thing, even though there's a lot of happiness and joy behind it, it takes some skill. And what these cookbooks provide are those skills. When you left art school, were you pursuing art still, or did you have this idea of a restaurant, of food?
No, not at all. I started off as a designer. I had my own designing office with my sister, who was a graphic designer at that point. And we worked together for about 5 years. Yeah, I think so. And then Oliver introduced me into the photography world a little bit. And through him, he asked me, you know, you can cook this. Could you, you know, I never knew that there was a job like food styling or something. I did not know about that. So when I got to know that, I thought, well, this is, you know, everything I like. It's like it's about cooking, but it's also composition, making a composition in as a picture, but also on a plate, thinking about colors and things like that. So that was an interesting thing, and I got to do that more and more, also on the side of designing as an interior architect.
So were there other cookbooks that you looked at and were inspired by, or was it all Dutch masters like Vermeer and Rembrandt?
Well, both. Yeah. Because the lighting of Vermeer and Rembrandt, for instance, is very interesting. It's really beautiful. But yes, there are many cookbooks I've been looking at and wondering, you know, wondering like, oh, one day I would love to make a book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's talk about those Dutch masters again, because you bring up the point of, you know, it being such beautiful light,
yeah,
but it was also natural light.
Yeah.
You know,
daylight.
Yeah. And it was natural food too. I mean, you talk about like Dutch alcove paintings. It was always the freshest, most, you know, beautiful oysters and stone
fish
fruits
and lemons.
Yeah,
and they all have meaning. I'm sorry, I cannot tell you what it meant. I remember that if there's a lemon,
yeah,
in it,
like a fish is a symbol for something.
Yeah,
probably
it has to make with religion.
Death. Yeah. and lemons as well. And,
yeah.
And,
things like that. They all have meaning,
yeah,
when they're put into a still life.
Yeah. I mean, do they have significance in a still life on a plate in a food photograph, though, too? Or are they just shapes and colors to you?
In food photography, I think it's more shapes and colors.
Yeah. But spiritually, I'm assuming lemons and, you know, fresh seafood means something. There's an attachment there. There's lots of oysters. I see them on your menu.
Yes.
I see herring, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you grow up with these things? Did your parents bring them into your house? Your many parents bring them into your house?
Well, herring is such a typical Dutch thing to eat that everybody eats it.
Yeah.
I mean, your parents will make you eat them until you like them. And then, but they're good. They're really, really good.
And it's fresh herring. It's not
It's pickled. It's brined.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And what are some of the classic dishes or preparations of that herring? Or is it just
you would
straight
eat it
brine?
Raw, yeah. And then mostly accompany it with either diced onions and pickled gherkins.
Yeah. So let's talk about the spread that's on the table with those herring. What else accompanies?
As a very Dutch point of view, gosh, what would we say?
Is it Heineken? Is there Heineken all over the place?
There's
yes, there's definitely beer and Geneva.
Yeah. And Geneva,
yes,
it's only hitting the States in the past few years. Can you
is
tell
it?
Me what it is? Yeah.
Well, it's a bit like you have old and young, yeah, Geneva. So young Geneva, which is young Geneva, is a bit like vodka, I could say.
Hmm? Yeah.
And the old one is more yellowy, and it would be more like cognac would be.
Yeah.
Like.
But it has the flavor of juniper, right?
Yes.
So
yes,
it's kind of like gin almost.
It's. I think it's actually the same word.
Yeah.
Geneva and gin. I mean, it's pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I would say more vodka kind of taste.
Yeah, it's more neutral.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the older it gets and the more tint it's got, the darker it gets, it gets more flavor as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The deeper flavor, not yeah.
So drinking's big over there. You enjoy a little
as
sip
big as in the States, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
We're doing our best.
Yeah. Because I've had a sips of Beringberg.
Beringberg,
yeah.
So it's a bitter, right?
Yeah, it's a herby drink.
Yeah, that's more like Jägermeister kind.
Yeah. But
you should not have too much of that.
No.
You'll be going a very wrong way.
But is it like shots? Is it like Skull and then you take one down?
It's it's like a shot.
Yeah.
And the proper way to drink Geneva actually is they have these glasses which are like curved like like a woman's body, you know, with a how would you say
the
that?
Curves.
Yeah,
the
curves. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very small little shot glass. And you would leave it
the counter.
On the counter, and the barman would pour it in, and it should be poured up to the end of the glass, and it would have a little bit of a top. You would not lift it because you can't. You will spill it. So you have to slurp it. From,
yeah.
Standing up like
what,
that.
What do Kuppenstadt? How do you say? Little headbutt. Because you're supposed to like...
Oh, Kopstad.
Oh,
there you go. Yeah,
that's
Kopstad.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a shot of Geneva with a beer.
Yeah.
With a Heineken.
Yeah. Oh, gotcha.
You would have a shot of that and then throw a beer
just
after
it.
Yeah. See, I may have had a couple too many little headbutts to
That's
not realize that I was having beer chasers with it as well. But there's so much fun, you know, cultural ways of enjoying a
of
lot
course.
Of Dutch food. And how have you translated that into, and how do you say your cafe's name?
And the Amstel. And the Amstel actually means at the Amstel River. Because in Amsterdam you have all these canals where we are very famous about. But there's one of them, which looks like a canal, is actually a river. And that is called the Amstel River. And that's where the city has started its first start, the beginning of the...
Well, it was the dam. It was the dam on the Amstel. Yeah. So that's where Amsterdam, the name of Amsterdam comes from.
Yeah. So at this river, we have our restaurant. So that's the actual name.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah. But we have, I wouldn't say... We have very local ingredients. We use very local ingredients, like I do in my book also. Very, you know, fresh produce. But I wouldn't say it's a very Dutch cuisine.
Yeah. No, I like that there are outside influences, you know, and with your travels, and we'll talk about, you know, being in France and Provence in a little bit. You know, you see Alsatian Flammkuchen, you know, you see, you know, well, steak tartare, which I think can be applied to a lot of places in the world. But you're not afraid to travel with your cuisine.
No, not at all. But it's also, we are in Europe and we're very close to all these countries where all this gorgeous food comes from, and we get to travel quite easily. So yeah, you pick up ideas from other countries and also from other cookbooks or from other chefs or from watching other shows or reading about things or inventing your own recipes just because you've tried something first. Like if you have had a regular steak tartare, you know it's really good. And then you try and think, like, how can we do this, but then it's going to be better or different. So that's how these things start off.
Yeah. See, now I'm wanting steak tartare. Yeah. Even though this pizza's in front of me, I want steak tartare
as
well.
Yeah, you should try it. We do it with a chopped oyster through it. It's very nice.
Well, we're going to take a quick little break and then come back and talk about Homemade, the cookbooks. Okay. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I actually hope you listened to that little commercial drop before, because we are a nonprofit and we are sponsored by our listeners, and you know,
which is nice.
Yeah, and you know, whatever you can give, whatever you can do, spread the word, because I think we're doing a cool thing here in the backyard of Roberta's Pizza and two Stevedore ship containers, and yeah, that
really cool studio.
Oh, can attest. It's like inside the fishbowl.
Yeah.
So what's awesome is that if you have a hankering for steak tartare and oysters, you can have them both in one dish.
Yes, you can.
Can you tell me where this was concepted from? Because this is just pure genius.
Oh, do you think so? I think. Well, we're always looking for substitutes. If you can use salt in your steak tartare, for instance, or mustard, but you could use an oyster too, because an oyster is also salt. So these are things that just come up. You know, we were discussing menus, like, and then everybody would say, "Oh, we should do it with that. Oh, we should do it with that," and then try it out and then just see how it works. So
yeah,
that's a bit of the main idea. How how we get there.
So, I mean, you talked about local, organic. You care about the quality of the products that you bring in the restaurant,
very much,
too.
Yeah.
And you keep a pretty small menu.
Yeah, that's for a special reason.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to waste things too much, and we also want to have the possibility of changing the menu whenever we want to. And we work with very small producers within the boundary of Amsterdam, actually. And they could call us and say, well, next week we have this finished, or that's growing really fast, and maybe you could put on the menu. So we can add that to the menu. And menus are always very short in writing, so we can be free and add things at the same night, and people would tell you at their table, like, just says veal chops, but we serve it today with, I don't know, curly kale or cavolo nero and butter beans and whatever.
Yeah.
So that can change. So we want the freedom to change whatever is available.
Yeah, I mean, there must be some standards too. You can't take the steak tartare off the menu, or people riot. Oh, you do.
We just
and
did.
Then you just have Oaf standing outside saying, no riot. Good thing still on the menu.
No, it might come back again. We have to change a little bit, because otherwise we have a lot of people coming back. So it's nice for them to have something different.
Yeah.
And also the chefs have to be, you know, interested in what they're doing. So it's also nice to keep them busy and trying new things, and we make another exciting dish, so that could be nice. Yeah.
Well, I think that's, you know, a very similar ideology to how you guys produce these cookbooks. Homemade, when did it start, and why did it start? Why was a cookbook necessary?
Well, it wasn't necessary, of course, but I just wanted to do it because I loved reading cookbooks myself, and I would spend, you know, mornings in bed with piles of books and just looking at pictures and reading recipes and reading styles of writing. And it was just a big wish. I had never imagined it to be such a great adventure as it has been. I just made it for myself, actually, like a sort of diary. And I was very happy. We were just, you know, we just said, well, if we just, you know, if it just gets, we just get the book published, that will be great. So
in Holland, that is.
Yeah.
We're pinching ourselves now because it's getting a little bit out of hand, which is good.
Yeah. It has been translated in so many languages. It was really incredible.
Yeah. And when you first produced the cookbook, was it just sold in the shop? Was it a small run? Was it?
It was. No, our Dutch publisher was pretty enthusiastic about it. So for Dutch standards, I don't know the exact figures, but yeah, the first run was pretty big for a cookbook, a Dutch cookbook, just for the Dutch market.
We were very proud of
that.
Yeah,
we were very nervous that we sell, that we won't be in the outlet after 3 weeks or so.
Yeah.
All these big piles of cheap books.
Yeah.
But that turned out fine. So in Holland, we're in the sixth or seventh printing, I'm not sure. But
wow. Yeah.
So it's
and
doing
we didn't get the English version until 2011
later.
Or something like that.
Yeah, it's a year after. All the books come out a year after.
And I think when it came here and I first saw the cookbook, I almost scolded you. I said, damn you for doing something I wanted to do. And by that, I didn't mean the topic, but having some kind of personal documentary of, you know, your life related to food in such a...
You
gorgeous.
Should do it. Why don't you do
what?
It?
Keep on telling me that.
Yes,
I need that.
Yes,
I need
every
that
book is
fire.
Fun for one.
Every book is different. Everybody's approach is different.
Yeah.
So.
But I mean, your approach is so personal and so joyful and around, you know, great food and great people and great events. How did you put bookends to this? How did you say the first book will just be homemade, the second book will be winter, the third book will be summer?
Well, I never thought of winter and summer at first. So I think I could have gone on making homemade. My publisher just said, you need to stop now. We have so many pages. And then we got some more pages even, because at the beginning, when you make a book, they calculate how many pages you're allowed to make for the price is going to be and blah, blah, blah. So these are all technical details, but they are important, of course. So, and then I had too many pages, so I begged my publisher for more pages, and he squeezed them in. He said, okay, but that is about it. And when I finished homemade, I had so much left. So that's how, summer and winter
Well, I'm glad you are. And I want to talk about summer right now in this beautiful 80 degree day.
Yeah.
Because I am craving a Negroni fig pop.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah. That looks good.
That will work, though. Yeah. It'll actually work on you.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a nice, because it's always bad when you make ice cream with alcohol and sugar, it's always very hard to get, you know, the measurements right, and it's that it will actually freeze up. But that just fits.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it works.
Again, that word celebration comes to my mind because this feels like something where you're like, yes, I have a Negroni fig pop, and you brandish it around and you eat it, you know, running in a field or by a, you know, beautiful vista. And most of the food feels like that to me, that there's a celebration not only of the ingredients, but of the people you're with. So let's go to Provence.
Yes.
Because some of this book is based there, an orchard outside near Avignon.
Yeah, right.
Is that where your family goes, where you you know, just hang out, or is there a special event?
Oliver,
I think
should
that's
tell
mine. Yeah,
yeah.
Oliver should tell this story.
No, my somewhere in the 60s, the parents of my dad's best friend by accident came across these this French family on a holiday bicycle trip, and they asked the family if they could stay in their orchard for put up their tent and stay overnight. And that was okay by them, and then so they met and they returned the next year. And these people from The Hague have been going there for 4 generations now, and we were sort of these were friends of my parents. So I got there the first time when I was 1 or 2, and we kept going there on holidays, and I introduced Yvette, and they totally fell in love with her, and the other way around. So we go there almost every year, twice a year. Yvette's been working there for over a month this spring, to do some real work, and it's a very wonderful and special friendship we have with the French family there.
Yeah,
and it's so cool to go there.
And
it's
this is old George.
This is old George's
brother.
Charles. Yeah, and his brother, and then they have cousins who are more our age, also living there where we are staying. They teach us a lot of things because they have a very traditional way of life, and that's quite interesting.
Yeah,
because we don't have these same traditions, so it's always nice to learn about other people's traditions. Like you were asking me about the herring and the Berenburg. It's also that's what I'm asking when I'm down there. They make all their liquors themselves. They make, you know, they have special celebrational cakes or dishes, and so I'm always writing everything down.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about those liquors, because there's a beautiful little passage about following old George around when he's putting the bottles on the trees.
Yes, that's so awesome. Exciting. Yeah. So when they have this big orchard, right, and it's with apples and pears, so they actually you know tie bottles with a bit of a big opening around blossoming flowers, hoping that a pear will grow into it. Instead of it growing by itself, it should grow into the bottle. So the bottles are actually tied up.
Upside down. To keep the rain out.
Yeah, to keep the rain out.
And then the blossom has to turn into a pear or fruit. And I don't know, one in every 5 works and the other all rot and die. But
yeah.
So they've got a small personal stash for them to keep them going through the winter. And then in spring they start all over again.
Yeah.
And they make, I don't know, 10, 20 bottles a year. It's really small.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. I never saw it before, but I did wonder. I bet you you've seen a bottle with a pear in it, and always been wondering how did they get the pear. Well, they do it like that.
Yeah,
and then they pour in I don't know alcohol and stuff, and they mix it, and then they leave it to macerate for about a year or something, and then they pop it open, and you get really drunk.
Yeah.
It's very strong.
Yeah, I mean, visually in my head that, you know, seems so amazing. And luckily you're a wonderful illustrator as well. And what's great about the books too is that you not only see how personal the food is, but that there's that personal touch of your illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad you didn't lose that, you know, that you didn't leave art school or leave design behind to pursue this, that you incorporated both things. How do you classify your drawings? I mean,
I wouldn't say I'm a very good illustrator. I just more. I think I just scribble things down. Actually, Well, you know, I actually made drawings because I sometimes don't want to write everything down. Sometimes it's quicker to draw it. You know, just you can say, you can draw an arrow and say, okay, put this bottle into that pot. You don't have to make the whole sentence. So it's actually, I use drawings also to be shorter, quicker, like a sort of lazy thing. No, it really is. And I try to be as personal as possible, because it's the only way I would know how to write, because it's out of a sort of personal, this is my personal story. I wouldn't know how to write it otherwise.
Yeah. Oh, do you feel like that's the same way you approach photography?
For the cookbooks, yeah. I do other stuff as well, but that's much more sort of staged and directed. Lots of commercial work for ad agencies and fashion magazines. But for the books, we try to keep it as simple as the recipes are. And also, the outcome of the picture should be sort of approachable for when you cook the recipe, it should look like the picture.
On the picture. Yeah.
On your plate. It should be sort of the, it can be a little bit of a downer if you see this beautiful, beautiful picture, which is perfectly lit, and then you try your best in making the recipe, and then the recipe turns out, the plate turns out completely different than the picture, and that's a bit of a drag, I guess.
Yeah.
So we try to keep it simple, a lot of daylight, a lot of just ambient light that's around, and then just try to cook it neatly, and then take a nice picture of it, and show the atmosphere of the atmosphere of the evening or the.
Oh, it certainly shows that there's a lot of atmosphere and fun happening.
Thank you.
Your home.
It's a mess. I'm sorry, but it's half kitchen, half studio, and it's.
Well, I mean, I think that's what I pictured a little bit, because the props are so wonderful, and I wouldn't even call them props because they're yours.
They are just ours.
Yeah,
we have a lot of plates.
Yeah, but when you cook at home, when you entertain, is it a big table? Is it lots of people over? Is it just you two?
No. It gets out of hand often.
Yeah. It gets out of hand a lot. Yeah, but it's also just to
good
us.
Fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We cook a lot together and enjoy it, and we always sit down at table and pour in a glass of wine and enjoy our dinners together too. Yeah.
I mean, if there's a takeaway from this book, would it be to enjoy what you're doing, not just with food, but in life?
I would say that. Yeah. Definitely.
And if you were to cook a meal for Yvette, what would it be, and Yvette for Ulf?
I would do a chopped salad too. I know she loves that. I would do it for me. I would be a big hunk of meat and like a guy's dinner. But if I would cook for Yvette because she's nice, I would do a sort of a chopped salad.
Just because
something.
I'm nice. Yeah.
No, it's a little grains in them and fresh herbs. She will love that.
Yeah.
I would.
And I'll put some mayo
pork
on it. And
pulled pork.
Oh, yeah. I would make him pulled pork.
And is it pulled pork? Is it like barbecue? Is it like Texas style? Where does that influence come in?
I think it is an American influence, actually.
Definitely,
but, Yeah, I put it in my winter book. I tried to put in that smoky flavor, so I experimented at home. And I know that pulled pork, we tried it once to make it, you know, for a 16-hour barbecue drive-in. I was really... We took turns and at the barbecue all night. But I make it in 5 hours in my smoker oven.
Yeah.
In the oven. And that works really fine. And it still stays juicy. And but also the smoky flavor.
Yeah.
And I would rub it in first. Yeah.
So I couldn't not mention dessert. I mean, we have all these wonderful proteins.
Yeah.
But my favorite part of your menu, aside from this now knowing what's chopped into the steak tartare...
Mm-hmm.
Are, you know, the cannelés, the clairs, coffee and chocolate. How important is a sweet ending?
Well, I'm a...
Sorry.
I said sweet.
Yeah. Got you there. Sorry.
I'm very fond of cake and pie and things like that. So you would always... You can easily... seduce me with a big piece of cake at the end of the dinner.
See, you're lucky it's radio. Aside from that wonderful finish, there are so many, and I didn't mean finishes in the country. there are so many amazing dishes that, you know, you not only make at your restaurant, but that are Dutch, that do inspire you. But you must also have your favorite food word. What kind of food words do you just think are just hysterical or really prophetic?
Oh, gosh.
And it can be in any language.
I'm just thinking right now. A food word. Give me an example. What would be your
pasta?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a funny thing. Whereas I see a word like bitterballen or stroopwafel, I'm like, oh, those are great. Do you see a word like pasta and be like, oh, that's a hilarious or that's a wonderful word?
No, I actually just had mung chung fish.
Yeah.
That was a word I had to practice a few times. Mung chung fish. That's the first thing that pops in my mind. I just had it here at Roberta's.
Yeah.
They did a vitella really tonnato, but then a sort of a pork. Not tonato, but
mung chung
natto. Yeah. It was really cool.
Yeah,
it was a wonderful dish. Yeah. Very, very nice.
And, I mean, I'm assuming from this meal that you had here, there are takeaways, there are ideas stirring in your head.
Well, actually, that dish was something we could have done too. Like, I like the fact that some things really work, like a vitella tonnato works, and then you take this as a sort of beginning, and then you just change it slightly with different ingredients and it becomes a different dish altogether. So that's inspiring, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the next season. After summer is?
After summer is a big... I was going to say a break, but that's not true.
Never again.
I wish it was. No, it's not. No. I do a lot of other things too. I work as a culinary editor. I write for magazines and newspapers in Holland. And I'm working on a new book, which I'm not going to tell you about.
That's fine. We'll have you back on.
Yeah, because we still have a year to finish it. So we'll just see which way it goes.
I was privy to Food and Wines. I think it's the May article where you talked about art and being that this is a show about art, artisans. Mm-hmm. I want to know how big an influence art is in your life still. And to food in Amsterdam. The two museums that just recently opened up are...
You're so up to date.
Yeah, I try.
Well, we're very happy that they opened up again. Of course, if you read the piece, I was also talking about the fact that because the art museums in Amsterdam were closed, and we're talking about the Rijksmuseum, which is the big classical museum, you know, for the Rembrandts are, and, you know, all the older works, and the Stedelijk Museum, which is the Museum of Modern Art, which was for a lot of people in Amsterdam very, you know, annoying that everything was closed for about 10 years or something, really a long time. And but what was good, what came from that, is that, you know, people started to open up to, like, pop-up galleries and, you know, because you still want to go somewhere. And even the Stedelijk Museum had its own sort of pop-up museum in buildings that were going to be torn down just for a year or 2 years, which was actually quite refreshing. Yeah. So something always comes from out of a sort of necessity or something. It always brings out something new, which is actually quite nice.
Yeah. So what are those other new things happening in you know, in Amsterdam right now, being a culinary, you know, editor and writer, what are you seeking out? What's exciting to you?
I find the fact that there is a sort of whole new movement in Amsterdam going on right now. I think here in Brooklyn, it would be more like how people are, how restaurants are here, and for us it is quite new, so I think you will be less surprised than we are. But real organic food growing them right on this on the spot, like here and Roberta's is a great example. That are things that are happening in our country right now too. A lot of urban farming and things like that are happening. A lot of things that are quite edgy. You know, you're not really sure if it's allowed or not, and they have to bend the rules a bit. So I like that. I like that. Yeah, like we had a big smoker oven in front of our restaurant for a little while. And we were just stretching it just as long, just waiting for the police to come one day. They came, so we had to, yours is my cousin who also is a owner of the restaurant, and he has put the smoker oven on his roof. so he's not annoying any people. So he has to, once a day, he brings the car down to his house, brings the fish in, smokes the fish, and then brings it back to the restaurant, because we're not allowed to smoke it in front of the house anymore.
That's part of the charm.
Ah, well.
I want to end with one quick thing.
Yeah.
Sinterklaas. And we won't go into the whole, like, who had Santa first debate.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
My friend used to get a big chocolate letter, or got it like 1 year.
Yeah.
Is it when you're really young, you get...
You still do it. It's tradition.
Yeah.
It comes with Santa Claus.
Yeah.
It's just one of your initials and then in a big chunk of chocolate.
Yeah.
And it's cool. It's nice chocolate. It's
just a nice tradition.
Yeah.
It's what... Yeah. Kids are allowed to set their shoe at the stove.
This is what I was going to ask. Yeah. Is this true?
That's what you do. Yeah. I like your parents make you believe that he really exists.
Yeah,
it's like Santa.
To keep you down and be a good boy for a while, Santa will take you back to Spain and smack you around.
You said back to Spain?
Yeah, he comes from Spain. Santa Claus lives in Spain. I don't know why.
Yeah.
And he comes by boat every year to celebrate his birthday with all the kids, and all the good kids get presents and all the bad kids get to be put in a sack and brought back to Spain, never to return again.
Interesting.
So you were always as a kid, you would always obey when he's in the country.
Bloody scared of him.
Yeah. Unless you're so scared.
Yeah, unless you want to go to Spain.
Yeah, there you go.
Not by yourself when you're 5 years old.
But can you tell me about this shoe? This is the most fascinating part. What do you put in it?
You put a carrot in it, or sugar cubes, or hay for Americo, his horse.
He comes
and
on a horse. And then
basically your dad takes out the carrot, puts a present in there, or a chocolate letter, and you're a happy camper the next morning.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's like filling stockings.
Yeah.
It's the exact same thing.
Yeah. In my head, conceptually, there's a dish there, though. With hay, with carrots, with sugar cubes. Have you ever taken these traditions and then put them back into your restaurant?
I think that's a great idea. Yeah. I have never done that before. We should
caramelized carrots smoked in hay. There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's wonderful stuff.
Yeah. Wow, we should do that. Thank you for the idea.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I will see you December 5th, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
This has been wonderful. I cannot wait until the next edition. I know I have to wait a year, but we'll have you back
I'm
on.
I'm sorry.
That is fine.
Great.
I'll make my way to Amsterdam, and I'll see you by that edge of the canal.
Great.
Do so. Great. You'll be more than welcome.
Excellent. Yvette, Hof, thank you again. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.